Well, every week, I think maybe we could do two chapters. But every week there's so much. I think one time we did manage to get through two chapters of Genesis in one night, but it seems like there is just so much there, and it seems surprising to us sometimes just how much is in the book of Genesis. Sometimes we think about those major stories of the creation and Noah, and we think about the things later on with Isaac being offered, or at least Abraham beginning to offer Isaac before he stopped, and we think about Joseph and him being sold by his brothers and those things, and sometimes we forget just how much more there is, how much richness there is in the book of Genesis. We're in Genesis chapter 17 tonight. Hope you have your Bibles and your pencil or your highlighter to highlight some verses, to make some notes. The heading at the top of my chapter 17 says, "The Covenant of Circumcision." It's interesting. The circumcision itself, God says, is the token. Just like when we talked about after the flood, the rainbow was the token of the promise that God made never to flood the earth again. But as we look at Genesis chapter 17, the first thing that we want to actually do is go back to the last verse from last week. If you remember that verse, it said Abram was 86 years old, or the more modern translations would say 86 years old, when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. He was 86 years old at the end of last week. At the beginning of chapter 17, in verse number 1, it says, "And when Abram was 90 years old and 9, 13 years have passed between the last verse of chapter 16 and the first verse of chapter 17. Now, you wouldn't think that what's not said is important, but often what's not said can be very revealing. For one thing, what we learn is that the day-to-day activities of mankind are only significant as far as they interact with the will of God. Because the Bible is not the history of man. When we study about what is the Bible, we thought it's not a history book. It's not a science book. We're going to look at some interesting scientific facts in this chapter tonight. But it's not a science book. It's not a history book. It's not a geography book. That's not what it is. It is an autobiography of God's relationship with men. It's not a complete and total autobiography of God. There's a lot about God that's not in this book. It's simply where mankind interacts with God's will. And that's what's revealed to us in these scriptures. And so, when we find that 13 years has just passed by and not a word mentioned of what happened in those 13 years, it tells us that nothing significant to God's plan, nothing of significance to God's will occurred during those 13 years. Now, there were a lot of things that happened in Abraham's life during those 13 years. Any of us who have lived 13 years know that 13 years is a good bit of life. A lot of things happen. Abram probably committed some sins during that time. Abraham probably did some good deeds during that time. A lot of things may have happened. Abraham was involved in raising Ishmael for 13 years of his life. And yet none of that is mentioned because it doesn't have an impact directly on God's will for mankind. And so it wasn't significant enough for us to know about it. Do you realize that 13 chapters in the book of Genesis, out of 50 chapters in Genesis, 13 of those chapters cover the entirety of Abraham's life. Now that includes chapters about Lot, that includes chapters about Isaac's wife, and about Isaac as well, and some things about Ishmael, but 13 chapters and a few verses. From chapter 12 to chapter 25 and just a few verses in 25. And that's it. Covers 175 years. In just those few short pages. Now, you've probably seen people's biographies or autobiographies, and they're this thick for somebody who's lived 60 or 70 years. And yet God made this much for somebody that lived 175 years. In fact, we didn't even meet Abraham till he was already 75 years old. That's when we met him. And then there are huge gaps. We see that from Ishmael's birth to Isaac's birth, there's a big gap in there. Here are these 13 years that just aren't even mentioned. And then from Isaac's birth until God's test of Abraham, when Isaac was already big enough to carry the firewood and climb up the mountain with his father, nothing's mentioned during that time. And then after that, from that test until Sarah's death, nothing more is mentioned. And then from Sarah's death, and then Isaac's marriage is there. But after Sarah's death and Isaac's marriage, then there's nothing else until Abraham's death. That's amazing. You see, God picks what He believes to be important. If a man had written the Bible, how many of the details would be in here? What does God say about Abraham's wealth, for example? Abram was very rich in cattle and in silver and in gold. Now you know, if a man had written that, he would have told exactly how many head of cattle Abram had, exactly how much silver he had, exactly how much gold he had. Because men care about those kinds of things, but God didn't care. That wasn't relevant to God, and it didn't impact His plan for mankind. The amount of wealth that Abraham had wasn't significant. So the things that are in there are not necessarily the things that we might expect to see. Because God has a different purpose for His writing the Scriptures. In fact, in all, less than 1% of Abraham's life is actually revealed to us. And we notice here in verse 1 of chapter 17 as well, the Lord appears to Abram. This isn't the first time that the Lord has appeared to Abram. But when He does this time, He says, "I am the Almighty God. Walk before Me and be thou perfect." Abraham has a part to play. Abraham has a role. He has some expectations from God. God expects certain things of him. He still expects certain things from us today. God has always been one who would make great promises, but so many times those promises were conditional. When we look back to Noah and the flood, and after the flood, the rainbow, there were no conditions there. God just said, "I promise, it's a covenant forever. No matter what, I'm never going to flood the whole earth with water again." But that was a rare promise. Most of God's promises are, "If you, then I'll." He says, "You do this, and I'll do my part. But if you don't do your part, you can't expect God to do His part." We understand that, don't we? When we go to get a car, and we sign the paperwork at the car dealer, and we drive off, and that's our car, but we still owe $28,567.43 on it, right? But it's our car. But guess what? It's our car conditionally. We've got to make those payments, don't we? We've got to pay for that car. If we just drive off with it and say, "Oh, it's my car," and we never make the payment, guess what happens? Oh, you don't have to guess. You've seen it happen. They come get that thing and take it back because it wasn't yours. You see, God gives us conditions. We've got to meet the conditions before He is bound to do what He said He would do. He always lays it out that way for us. Tells us what we've got to do. Tells us what He'll do. Tells us if we don't do what we're supposed to do, what will happen. So He says in verse 2, He's already said, "You walk before Me and be perfect." And then in verse 2 He says, "I'll make My covenant between Me and you, and I'll multiply you exceedingly." Now this is many times He's already told Abraham this. Almost every time He talks to Abraham, He says, I'm going to multiply your seed. I'm going to give you many seed, many descendants. There are going to be so many, the stars. You won't be able to count them. He says this over and over again. And here now, the first time he said that, Abraham was 75. Now Abraham's 99. He hadn't got it yet. And he's beginning to wonder if it's ever really going to happen. And this guy, God comes down and he promises me these things, but here I keep going and going and going. It's been 25 years and I hadn't gotten it yet. We talked about last time that God doesn't work on our time schedule. But if Abraham will do his part, then God will multiply him. But here it is. Abraham and Sarah still have no child. Then in verse 3, look at the reverence. Even though he's beginning to wonder about this promise, you still look at the reverence that Abraham has for God. Abraham fell on his face before God. When was the last time you fell on your face before God? Now, not necessarily even physically, but spiritually, emotionally. When was the last time you just opened yourself up and just laid out there in front of God and let Him know where you were and where He was and how much higher He was than you were? When's the last time we humbled ourselves? You know, to lay yourself flat on the ground in front of someone, that's a pretty humbling position, isn't it? I mean, I know we had several people got upset at the president because he bowed to someone, right? What if he'd have laid down flat on the floor on his face in front of somebody? Then what would they have? Oh, we just don't do that. We are too good to do it. We got too much self-respect to do that. But when we come into the presence of God, we better not be too proud. We better not think too highly of ourselves. We need to get down before Him and let Him know how great He is and how humbled we are to be with Him. And God talked to Abraham there. Oh, what a wonderful thing to have that kind of a relationship where God talked to you. That's one of the things that I look forward to in heaven. I know God speaks to us through His Word, but to actually speak to God, to actually hear Him speak back to me, I look forward to that. I don't know about you. But then in verse 3, he goes on to say, "My covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations." And then he says, in fact, your name's not going to be Abram anymore. And this is where he changes his name. He says, you're going to be called Abraham. Abram meant high father. Seems an odd thing to name a baby. Apparently Abram was already named High Father. Maybe it was because it made his father feel high as a kite when he was born, and he named him that because of that. I don't know. But he named him High Father. But God changes his name to Father of a Multitude. Now remember, at this point, Abraham only has one son, and that son is not even the one that God's been promising him. That one's by a servant. But God changes His name. And He says, I'm going to make you exceedingly fruitful. I'll make your nation, I will make nations of you, and kings shall come out of you. He's not just going to be fruitful and multiply. He's going to produce entire nations. How many of you expect that you'll ever father a nation? Be the mother of a nation? Oh, that's the time for that is past. But at the time that God speaks to Abraham, the nations were still being created. There were still nations to come. And Abraham is going to father some of those nations. In fact, verse 4 had said, you will be the father of many nations, not just one. Often we think about Israel and we think, oh, well, Abraham's the father of the Israelites. But that's not the only nation that Abraham fathered. Other nations as well. And we'll look at some of those as we go further on into the book of Genesis. Then verse 7. The covenant is going to be established, again, with Abraham and his seed. And it's going to be, look at the wording there, an everlasting covenant. We got caught up sometimes on the word everlasting. Because in English, we think everlasting, well, that means forever. And we know nothing on earth lasts forever. In the Old Testament, throughout the Old Testament, the term everlasting is used in two different ways. One is that it sometimes actually means age lasting. It means it will last till the end of the age. Well, we know that when we're talking about the Old Testament, the end of the age came with Christ. That Old Testament age came to an end and the New Testament age began. But then also sometimes the term everlasting simply means long lasting, as long as I live or as long as we live. David and Jonathan made some agreements like that that were everlasting. Well, they couldn't make something that was really everlasting because they were human beings. But they meant as long as I live, that's the way it's going to be. I'm going to do what I'm supposed to, as long as I live. In that sense, marriage is designed to be an everlasting covenant. Now, we know that it doesn't last on into eternity. It doesn't last in heaven. That we're not going to have marriage in heaven. But as long as we live, and then when one dies, then that covenant is broken. And the Bible teaches us that. But that's the idea. But here, since God is going to make this not only with Abraham, if He was going to make it an everlasting covenant with Abraham, then when Abraham died, the covenant would die with it. But He said, I'm going to make an everlasting covenant with you and your seed after you. So God's going to continue this covenant on down through the years, beyond just the life of Abraham. On and on it's going to go. But remember, that second meaning, which was the first one we mentioned, the age lasting, there is going to come an end to it. God's covenant has changed now. We're under the new covenant, which is a better covenant, built on better promises, Hebrews tells us. Better promises than all these things. He promised Abraham a lot of children. He promised Abraham a nation. He promised Abraham that his descendants were going to get the promised land of Canaan. Well, what better promises could there be than that? Well, we've got them. We're promised heaven. Heaven's better than any piece of dirt you can buy anywhere. It's the best. We're promised forgiveness. We're promised spiritual blessings that Abraham could only have dreamed of. So there are better blessings under the new covenant. But this covenant was an important one. And in fact, the New Testament writers allude back to this covenant that's made with Abraham. And how through his seed, he's going to be a blessing. And the world was going to be blessed through his seed. And in Galatians, Paul explains to us that seed is Christ. Christ is the one that blessed us all because of this covenant. And so this covenant carries through to bring us to Christ, that one who was going to bless all nations. But then as we look at it even further, we notice he again promises him in verse 8 that he's going to give him the land. He promises him in verse 9 that you shall keep my covenant. Well, wait a minute. What do you mean I'm going to keep your covenant? What did Abraham have to do? Abraham had to walk before God and be complete and be faithful to God. See, that was back in verse 1. That's what Abraham had to do. And again, God's covenant was conditional. There are some people today who still believe that the descendants of Abraham deserve to have that certain little strip of land over there because God promised it to them. But God only promised it to them on the condition that they kept His covenant. And His covenant with them was that they walk before Him and obey Him. Be obedient to Him and be faithful to Him. When they failed to be faithful to Him, God wasn't bound to keep that anymore. Just like if you're buying a house, and we've had an awful lot that have been through this boat lately, where they thought they had a house, but they didn't make the payment, the bank wasn't bound to let them live in that house anymore. They'd kick them out, take the house back, sell it to somebody else. Well, God's not bound to let the Israelites live in that land if they're not keeping His covenant. And He's not bound to let us into the promised land of heaven if we won't keep our covenant with Him either. Some people think God owes them something. God doesn't owe anybody anything. Who has ever given anything to God that God owes them and needs to pay them back? The New Testament asks that question as well. But then we look to verse number 10, and He says, "This is My covenant which you shall keep between Me and you and your seed after you. Every man-child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt Me and you." That circumcision, it itself was not the covenant, but it was the sign of the covenant. It was a fleshly, physical reminder of the spiritual covenant that they were supposed to have with God. And there it was. Every time they performed the circumcision, every time a little boy was born, and we'll see, he says in verse 12 that on the eighth day, when he's 8 days old, he circumcised. So every time a little boy was born and he was 8 days old, they circumcised him every time. That was a reminder that we're supposed to walk before the Lord and be perfect before Him. And He'll give us these blessings. Every time they did that, it was supposed to be a reminder to them of that. That's what a token is. Just like that wedding band, every time you look at it, you remember you're married. That's the point of a token. And so it was to remind them. Now notice verse 12 though. He that's 8 days old shall be circumcised among you. Every child in your generations, he that's born in your house or bought with money from a stranger, which is not of your seed. But I want us to focus on that eighth day. Why? Why the eighth day? I mean, wouldn't you want to just do that as soon as, you know, baby's born, go ahead and do it right then. He's already yucky from the birth anyway. You might as well do it right then. And then clean him up. No, we're going to wait till the eighth day, and then we're going to do it, and he's going to bleed, and we've got to clean him up. Why do it that way? Well, I want us to notice something. This is an article from Apologetics Press. It says this, in Genesis 17:12, God specifically directed Abraham to circumcise newborn males on the eighth day. Why the eighth day? In 1935, a professor H. Dam proposed the name vitamin K for the factor in foods that helped prevent hemorrhaging in baby chicks. Now we know about vitamin K. It's responsible for the production by the liver of the element known as prothrombin. You might not have heard that word before. We've heard of vitamin K, but prothrombin is a different kind of word. But if vitamin K is deficient, there will be a prothrombin deficiency as well, and hemorrhaging may occur. Oddly, it is only on the fifth through the seventh days of a newborn's life that vitamin K begins to be produced. So there's no vitamin K before days five through seven. It starts being produced on day five. And then it's present in adequate quantities. Vitamin K coupled with prothrombin causes blood to clot or coagulate. That's what it does. That's when your blood clots, it's those two things, vitamin K and prothrombin. If you have too much of them, it can lead to blood clots, and that's not a good thing. And then they have to give you blood thinner and all those kind of things. But it says then that this is important in any surgical procedure. Anytime you get a cut of any kind, you want that blood to clot and seal over. There were a couple of other people, Holt and McIntosh, in Holt Pediatrics, observed that a newborn infant has peculiar susceptibility to bleeding between the second and fifth days of life because they don't have this vitamin K and because they don't have any prothrombin. Hemorrhages at this time, though often they're small, inconsequential ones, they are sometimes extensive. They may produce serious damage to internal organs, especially the brain, and even cause death from shock or exsanguination. I mean, they bleed to death. They bleed out. Because they don't clot. Just like a hemophiliac will bleed out. If they get cut, it won't stop bleeding. Obviously then, if vitamin K is not produced in sufficient quantities until days 5 through 7, it would be wise to postpone any surgery until sometime after that. But why day 8? Why didn't he just wait till 14? I mean, under the law of Moses, day 14, why not then? Or day 30, when the woman is ritually cleansed from giving birth, go ahead and do the circumcision of the boy that day too. Why day 8? Well, on the 8th day, the amount of prothrombin present is actually elevated well above the normal 100% level that it is for the rest of that child's life. That one day of his life is the perfect day to do surgery, because the levels necessary for the blood to clot. Now, do you think Abraham just figured that all out on his own? Abraham had no idea what vitamin K or prothrombin were. We didn't know. Well, some of us didn't know till now. But the scientific community didn't know until less than 100 years ago what to even name these things. And yet here it was. Thousands of years ago, God had it written down here. Why? He knew. He knew it needed to be on that day. It's an amazing thing. They are at their peak on that day, the things necessary to perform that surgery. Let's move on to verse number 13. Circumcision was for everyone born or bought in Abraham's house. It wasn't just an accident. It wasn't just, you know, pick a few, this one, that one. If you want to do it, you can do it. If you don't want to, you don't have to. It was for every male in the household. I bet the Jewish women were glad they weren't male. But it was a reminder constantly of this covenant that they had with God. Constantly reminding them of it. Those that were uncircumcised, verse 14 tells us, were to be cut off from their people. It's interesting that either you had your foreskin cut off, or you were cut off. You couldn't have it both ways. And so they were to be cut off. They were not considered to be God's people. They had violated the covenant, and they were kicked out, so to speak. In fact, circumcision was such an important part that later, even under the law of Moses, when they were not to do any work on the Sabbath day, guess what one thing they would do even on the Sabbath day? If a little boy was 8 days old on the Sabbath day, they'd circumcise him. Sabbath day or not. Because that covenant of circumcision came before the law. It was first. God gave that covenant before He gave the Ten Commandments. And it's interesting because all through the New Testament writers who are talking sometimes to Jewish people about the importance of the new law of Christ keep reminding them that Christ is the fulfillment of the promise of the covenant to Abraham, and it came first. It was before the Ten Commandments. It was before the law of Moses. It's more important. It's the one that we're supposed to be following. That revelation of fulfillment of that covenant through Jesus Christ. That's what brings... We don't go back to the law of Moses. It came later. It was just to bridge the gap from the time of the promise to Abraham till the time of its fulfillment. And that's an amazing thing. In verse 15, Sarai's name is changed to Sarah. And this one, they're both from the same root word, and not really sure exactly why God chose to change her name. Might think that it could be that both of the names come from a word that means mistress or lady or princess or queen. And it could be that the slight variation there might be the difference between a princess and a queen. Maybe because she's going to have a son, she's moved from just being the princess to being the queen mother. I don't know that. But there's some reason that God chose to change her name too. Something's different. This new covenant, she's brought in on it, and now because of that, her name needs to be changed to something different. And God chose just a slight alteration of her original name. Verse 16, finally. Now remember, God's been promising Abraham, or Abram, for years now that he was going to have a son. And Abram thought he had figured it out when he did that little thing with Hagar a few years back, 13 years ago. And he thought that was it. Hey, I've helped God out. We talked about that. But now finally, God makes it clear to Abraham, the son that I'm talking about that you're going to have is going to be by Sarah. You're going to have a son by Sarah. and she's going to be a mother of nations. Of course, she's not going to be the mother of as many nations as Abraham is the father of, because she is only the mother of one of his eight children. Did you know Abraham had eight children? I'll look that up. This one next time. She's only going to have one. Isaac's the only one she has. Of course, he has Ishmael. We know about those two. He had six other sons. Six other sons that he had after Isaac. Now, earlier, Abraham fell on his face in reverence before God. Now, however, Abraham's attitude's a little bit different. In the texting world that they have nowadays, he probably, we could have shortened this to LOL or ROFL, which means laughing out loud or rolling on the floor laughing. Abraham falls on his face again, but this time, he doesn't fall on his face in reverence and humility before God. He falls down laughing. Because God has just told him that this nearly 90-year-old woman's fixing to have a baby. What do you think? 90-year-old woman's fixing to have a baby. We might laugh too. That sounds a little unusual, to say the least. In our modern era, I believe the oldest woman to have a baby was about 60 years old. I don't know about you, but that's a pretty good age to be chasing after a little one, if you ask me. But she's nearly 90. Now, I know people lived a little longer back then. But Abraham knew people lived a little longer back then, and he still laughed. He thought that was just a funny joke that Sarah was going to have a baby. In fact, he just can't believe that a 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman could have children. And he questions God on it. And so in verse 18, he again tries to make the compromise with God. Okay, God, I know you made that promise, but I'm going to let you out of it. You ever had somebody promise you something that you knew they couldn't keep? You knew there was no way they could do it, and so you let them off the hook. And Abraham tried to let God off the hook. He said, you know what, God? Just let Ishmael live before you. Let him be the one. Here he is. He's 13. He's right here ready. Let's let him be the one. But that's not the way God works. God doesn't compromise. When he has a plan, he carries out his plan. And God says no. And in fact, he names the one that he's going to accept to be a part of the covenant that he's making. And that boy's name is not Ishmael, it's Isaac. God named him before he was even conceived. God said his name's going to be Isaac. And so the covenant was going to be with Isaac and not Ishmael. God blessed Ishmael in verse 20, and God said he's going to multiply Ishmael, and he was going to make a great nation of him. He was going to give him 12 kings or 12 princes, 12 rulers as sons. And in fact, if you look down to Genesis 25, 12 through 16, you'll find out Ishmael had 12 sons who became the rulers of various different tribes that later most likely became various nations over in that part of the world at some time. They may not still be there today. They've probably been absorbed into some of the larger groups. But at that time, they were nations. 12 sons Ishmael had. I won't name them all for you because I can't remember their names. For some reason, we remember better those 12 sons of Jacob than we do the 12 sons of Ishmael. We use those names more often. But then in verse 21, God gets very specific. Finally, he's been promising for 25 years, going to give you a son, going to give you a son, going to give you a son. Oh, going to give you a son by Sarah. Now he finally says, next year, at this set time, next year. So here we are, it's September 11th. Next year, September 11th. That's pretty specific. Now, it wasn't September 11th, as far as I know. I suppose there's a 1 in 365 chance that that was the day. But he said, this day, next year, you're going to have that son. Isaac's going to be born 1 year from today. And then, in verse 22, God went up from Abraham. It's something. God didn't just walk away. He went up. Abraham could have watched him go. Verse 23, Abraham keeps the covenant, or at least the token of it, of that he is going to keep God's covenant. And that he himself is circumcised at age 99. Ishmael is circumcised at age 13. They were circumcised the same day as part of a covenant. Interestingly enough, Ishmael at 13 has to go through the pain of circumcision. And if you haven't been through that pain, it's a painful experience. And he went through that painful experience at 13 years old to fulfill part of a covenant that he himself was never going to be the beneficiary of. He was never going to receive the rewards of that covenant because Isaac was the one that God had chosen. And yet, he had to go through that and suffer that pain all the same. And in fact, he's going to, we'll see soon, be kicked out of the home anyway. He doesn't even get to remain and enjoy his father's favor for the rest of his father's life. They're all circumcised that same day. All of the men in the house. Not just most of them. Not 95%. All of them. Now I know that God doesn't call on us to keep the covenant of circumcision today. But He does call on us to walk before Him and be faithful to Him. Trust in Him completely. Give ourselves to Him completely. Are we doing that? Are we following that example that our faithful father Abraham set for us? We talked this morning about looking at passages and looking for examples to follow. Abraham kept his part of the covenant. Are we keeping our part? Are we doing what we should do? If you're not tonight, realize that if you don't keep your part of the covenant with God, He's not bound to keep His part either. If you're not keeping obedience to Him, if you're not walking before Him faithfully, He's not going to just let you waltz into heaven like that. He locks the gates against those who are not walking faithfully. If you need to respond this evening, if you need to get your life right and get back on track and walk before Him faithfully, not just in some things, but all the way, 100%. And I know none of us are perfect. Abraham wasn't perfect either. We're going to see some more of his sin a little later on in Genesis. But the faith to know that when I do sin, I'm going to repent of that. I'm going to turn back to God. I'm going to do what's right in God's sight. If you need to respond to the invitation, there's no better time than tonight. Please do so as we stand and as we sing.